I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today is Leslie Carhart, Principal Industrial Incident Responder at Dragos Inc. Leslie has spent 13 of her 20-plus year career specializing in information security, with a heavy focus on incident response to nation-state adversary attacks. You can visit her website at tisiphany.net and follow her on Twitter at hacksforpancakes. Welcome, Leslie. So happy to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Leslie, as I mentioned in the intro, you've been in this industry for some time now. So to start off, can you share with us a little about your career and what maybe sparked your interest initially in cybersecurity?
Yeah, so I actually started programming as a very young kid, 8 or 9. I grew up on a farm, and at some point, this is early home PC days. My father leased a computer, he wanted to do farm accounting and inventory and such. And so, at that point, as a young kid on a farm, I had 2 choices: it was learn how to work on the farm or learn to program the computer. And I decided that programming the computer looked a lot more interesting to me. So. Yeah, I spent a lot of time doing that as a kid. I learned to program pretty well. I got my first job as a programmer when I was 15. I mean, it was a different era then. It was the dot-com boom. And I guess if you could program well, you could get a job, even if you were a ridiculous kid. The world doesn't necessarily work like that anymore. But that got me really involved into the tech and then accordingly, the hacking community in Chicago at the time met a lot of people who were early on into that niche, into that field of cybersecurity and computer hacking, and it really sparked my fascination in that, especially in the area of computer forensics, which is where I spend a lot of time today.
Very cool. And I did some research on you, of course, and I saw on your LinkedIn that you've been with the Air Force Reserve for over 14 years. And many folks who have been in the military or armed services, they find themselves in cybersecurity. So I'd love to hear from you how that type of experience really prepares folks for cybersecurity and protecting us, organizations, and enterprises against cyber warfare and cyber crime.
It's important to remember that there's an incredibly diverse number of backgrounds and personalities and educations in the United States military. And that's wonderful. I mean, if you want to fill a role, you can find somebody who's had an excellent education in that thing in the military somewhere. For people who have had something of a investigative or computer background, cyber background in the military, there's endless opportunities to apply that experience into commercial job roles. There's certainly a deficit of people right now, especially in mid to the senior level cybersecurity roles. So there's plenty of opportunities for people to take that very excellent pipeline training that the military offers and move it into the civilian workforce.
I want to come back to the issue of the cyber talent gap in a second, especially with regard to mid to senior roles, because that's not something I've talked about a lot with folks, but it's something that I know you have a POV on. But before that, I in the intro, I mentioned your role at Dragos. So can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to be responsible for senior level incident response, host and memory, digital forensics, threat hunting, etc.? I mean, it sounds really cool to me, but it's not something I know a lot about. So I'd love to hear more from you.
Yeah, so Dragos is specifically a company that's focused in securing critical infrastructure. So things like power, water, oil and gas, manufacturing, transportation. So things that keep kind of society functioning from a computer perspective. And that's exclusively what we do. So I'm part of this small number of people in the world who, when there's like a power plant hacked, goes out and tries to figure out what happened. So that's what my job role of incident response really is. It's being the firefighter. Somebody's had an intrusion, somebody's been hacked into, ransomed, or extorted, et cetera. They've had data stolen, or they've been sabotaged physically through their digital devices. I go out there with my team and we try to figure out what happened, how bad the damage is, the scope of it, and then how to restore services and keep the adversary from doing the same thing again.
And does that happen pretty often? I mean, obviously, it's often enough that it's a component, a large component of this industry. But just to your point, maybe that's not something folks know a lot about. And that actually happens pretty often, I think. But you correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, so incident response is a very busy business, especially in the age of ransomware, where companies are getting ransomed all the time, and it has major disruptive impacts on their operations. There's always the more state-style adversary activity going on too, the espionage, particularly corporate espionage, theft of trade secrets, theft of operational data, financial data, customer data, et cetera. So that stuff's happening all the time. In terms of industrial, where I am specifically, what we see a lot of is foothold building. It's very costly to launch an attack against an industrial environment. It takes a lot of time, a lot of expertise to do it in a specific targeted way. So the smart and resourced adversaries right now are breaking into networks, figuring out what's there and what they might be able to do in the future, and establishing a foothold or a beachhead so that they can, in a year or 5 years, launch some kind of attack against that infrastructure.
Oh, wow. So there's like a long-term play there that they're working toward. Interesting. So it's not a quick reward by any means, but there's potentially a large reward for them if they're able to, you know, with ransomware or something like that, then it makes it worth it.
Yeah, you don't want to just take down the power to a city or something. That's obviously, you're going to have everybody in the planet is going to start investigating you, and your tactics are going to be blown. The infrastructure you spend a lot of time and money on is going to be gone. That's something you want to do with a specific reason. So these adversaries that are more well-resourced are, they're hedging their bets. They're saying, hey, what if there's conventional warfare or a trade war or a major like trade dispute or something that, or maybe an election we want to interfere with in 5 years? What might we want to leverage at that time? So instead of having to do the work then of figuring out how that specific facility, like the power plant or the water treatment plant, the sewage treatment plant, the transportation hub, instead of having to figure that out on the fly as they want to launch an attack in, say, 5 years from now, they're spending the time and effort and money right now to do that reconnaissance so they can create their own repositories of information and understand how to do that in the future when there's a geopolitical reason to.
Very interesting. And you mentioned you go out to wherever the incident is that warrants a response. How has COVID-19 impacted that? If at all.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely been impactful incident response. Now, a lot of my work is entirely digital. I'm looking at hard drives, memory images on computers, removable media, things like that, cloud. And so a lot of what I do is sit in front of a computer, but incident response is a holistic thing. It's not just figuring out who done it. It's also figuring out how to restore services. It's conveying what's happening in a coherent narrative to executives, to leadership, to shareholders. So there's a lot of reasons why companies like to have an incident responder on site physically during an incident, whether that's somebody from their own team or it's somebody like me who's brought in on a retainer or just a consulting fee. So people were a lot more comfortable with having us on the site, but there's kind of multiple layers of travel restrictions right now, because sometimes those sites have restrictions about what visitors, guests, contractors can come on site and how often they can do that. And then there's potentially restrictions with like geographic areas restricting travel. International travel's incredibly restricted right now. So companies, organizations, both service providers and customers of incident response services are going to have to continue to adapt to that for a while. It doesn't really impact our ability to do the investigative work, but a lot of those more human interfacing things, people don't get that security blanket of a person being on site with them necessarily. And that can absolutely be done over teleconference, over Zoom, over WebEx, et cetera. But it's a big adaption on the part of the people in those companies.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I definitely can see the value and feeling very taken care of by having someone physically there with you.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense. And it is very much an investigation that you do, which is very interesting. So what is it about that that really interests you and made you want to go down that path?
Yeah. So when I talk to students, and I do a lot of mentoring of junior talent, you know, one of the big pieces of advice that I give junior people is kind of figure out what niche of cybersecurity you want to get into, because there's so many different roles in cybersecurity and they all require different backgrounds of technical skill, but also different personality types to be really happy in them. Penetration testers tend to have very different personality traits than incident responders, than exploit researchers, than assessors and auditors and governance people. We all like different things in terms of analytics, in terms of risk tolerance, in terms of our ability to sit there and stare at great quantities of data for hours on end, or our desire to interact with people constantly. So incident response is kind of a space where you have to really enjoy the detective work. You really have to enjoy, and real detective work isn't like the movies. It isn't like television, of course. It's very painstaking, time-consuming work of looking through evidence in a very analytical, detached way, and trying to corroborate what happened with multiple pieces of evidence to create a coherent narrative about what the bad guys did. So if you don't like doing that for hours and hours and hours for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, it's maybe not the job for you. But if you have that kind of mindset of really liking to figure out the mystery by very carefully and analytically taking apart evidence for an extended period of time and constructing this timeline and this narrative of what happened, then it's a great job role. And I really enjoy it.
That's awesome. I'm glad you brought that up. Mentorship and junior talent. Like I said earlier, I read a recent post on your website, tisiphany.net, addressing hiring managers who want to hire more diverse senior people. And I found your post especially interesting because regarding the job requirements, one specific example you gave with the job requirement in a posting was distilling down essentially what they were looking for. And it distilled down to a talent pool of about 4 people, including yourself. So not a lot, you know, not a lot of options there. Not guaranteed everyone in that is looking for a new job either. So we speak a lot about the cyber talent gap with folks, but it's often more geared toward people entering cyber and starting their cyber career, kind of how to get a foot in the door. But I'd love to hear you weigh in on this, especially with regard to what you wrote about and how companies can address this issue.
Yeah. So I just recently wrote a blog about this because I had a few people approach me asking how to hire more people like me. So not straight white men in my role, which is digital forensics and incident response or more senior level cybersecurity. And that is a really huge problem in cybersecurity right now. And so my response was kind of twofold. So first of all, there isn't a pipeline gap. There are plenty of talented young people who want to learn cybersecurity, and they are eager to learn, or not just young people, but people moving in from other fields who want to cross train into cybersecurity, but novices. That novice talent pool is huge. And sometimes that means investing in those people because they can't afford to go to a 4-year college and get the perfect ideal degree that you're asking for from the right school. You're limiting your talent pool drastically by demanding things like very expensive degrees or certifications, when there's other ways that people could show their desire and motivation to learn and build those fundamental skills. We could do much better, much like the military, in building pipelines that teach people from the ground up to be junior analysts. So that's how you start building that pool out. And then if you start looking at the more senior talent, we've been affected by that poor pipeline for a long time. So there are demographic inequities in senior, especially cybersecurity. And the way around that is, first of all, training up junior people to fill those roles and building good pipelines for them, but also not being artificially restrictive in the job postings for the senior roles. I still see a lot of you know, location restricted positions, even today during COVID, when a lot of work is remote and has been enabled to be remote for some time now, half a year, a year. I see odd restrictions for certifications that are kind of, again, just they're pointlessly exclusionary. And the example that I gave in my blog, and I don't have it right in front of me at this moment, but I was looking into malware reversers in the Chicago area. And I get a lot of calls about malware reversing positions in Chicago from recruiters. It's pretty perpetual. But I actually took a look in LinkedIn to see what is actually available. So I said, okay, so they are looking for people in a lot of these job postings who have the GAC GREM reverse engineering certification. And that's a something like $6,000 to $7,000 course and certification. So it's not something that a lot of people pay out of their own pocket for. Maybe your employer pays for it. So there's this very expensive certification. So that's the first barrier there. And they're looking for somebody with a tremendous amount of experience too. So, you know, a decade or more of experience most of the time. So we filter down LinkedIn to that and we get like a pool of, I don't remember, but a couple dozen people. And then I went one by one and I went through those profiles to see if there's anybody who looked like they identified as a woman. I also looked at people who weren't white, who were people of color. And, you know, just these minority groups. And I got this tiny number of people, I think it was like four people who met those criteria inside Chicagoland. So that's why I'm getting all these calls from recruiters. And it's just bonkers because first of all, this job can be done, reverse engineering can be done remotely. And second of all, why aren't you training up junior people to fill those roles? If you're really invested in having a diverse workforce and having a diverse talent pool, you've got to understand that there's been inequities in the InfoSec hiring pipeline for a long time, and we're just starting to counterbalance them. So that's something that people have to actually work for. So there's a lot of problems there, but the people are there. People are there and they're awesome and they should get the jobs.
Right. And you, I know you don't have it right in front of you, but it's very fresh in my mind. You made a really great point about how companies can be, I guess the only word that comes to mind is fearful. So they can become a little fearful of spending a lot of time and money and investment in training folks to become more senior. And you know, their fear is that they'll end up leaving for a different company, for a different job. But then you spoke to the military and how, you know, the idea is if every company is doing that, then we won't have this pipeline issue.
Yeah. And of course, there's that constant paranoia. And I hear it from hiring managers all the time. I'm going to invest $7,000 in a SAN cert and I'm going to invest a year of training and then this person's going to leave. Yes, they probably are going to leave after a couple of years because most companies today aren't offering very significant cost of living raises or pay increases on a yearly basis anymore. You can usually get paid a lot more by jumping to another company. How do you fix that? Well, you pay your people reasonably when they get a promotion. You don't give them a 2% increase when they're going to get a 10% increase for going to another company and doing the same work. Besides that, yes, people are going to leave. And if every large organization with the resources to build a good cybersecurity training pipeline did so, then they wouldn't be feeding off themselves. They would be, you know, exchanging people, which is a really healthy thing to do, actually. You know, you want to have your analysts have experience in small and mid-size and large enterprises in a variety of verticals. That makes them more well-rounded cybersecurity professionals. So if you have and we're lucky in Chicago, we do have a few organizations who do have those good pipelines. And what you see is people spend 2 years as a entry-level junior analyst at one, and then they move on to the other one as a senior analyst, maybe, and then they move on to another one as an incident responder. But they're trading these people amongst each other, and they're getting a variety of experiences. So when companies work together to build good pipelines, then we have a healthier pool of talent. It's just such a common sense thing, but people are so paranoid that people are going to leave. But they're going to leave anyway. They're going to leave if you don't train them. Like,
yeah, that's a great point. I'm really glad that you spoke to that. Thank you. And I guess to build on that, you share on LinkedIn that you organize and support resume and interview clinics at cyber conferences. And why is that such an important mission for you, even outside of your day job, so to speak?
You know, it's just kind of something I fell into. I like to write. I really enjoy writing fiction, nonfiction, things like that. So reading language and seeing what's correct and incorrect is very natural to me. And I review a lot of resumes as a senior person. Junior resumes, senior resumes, I just spend a lot of time going through them, hiring candidates. And I have for years in my career, and I know what works and doesn't work. And it's such a simple fix to have. I'm not a verbiage or style editor. I still encourage everybody who can afford to go to a professional resume editor and take their resume there, because there's trends, there's fads in resumes that, you know, they change their popular styles change every few years. So to get those things right, go see a professional editor. What I'm editing for when I do these clinics, and what my volunteers are editing for, is I get a bunch of hiring managers and we look at the resumes and say, this is the technical skill set that's missing entirely from your resume. This is what I didn't read when I scanned it. This is what I was looking for and I didn't see. This is what you're not conveying properly to me. This is where you're not showing what role you want to get into well. And this is where you're not showing what your previous successes were. So that's the kind of thing that we're identifying at those clinics. And those are such easy fixes. And really, I can't stress to people who are applying for cybersecurity jobs or any technical jobs how important your resume is, because it can be the difference between a hiring manager seeing your resume at all, or it just being totally discarded by an automated system or an HR person. And that's just a sad truth of the game. I didn't make the game. I just live in a world where it runs. But your resume is really important. Conveying what you want to do and who you are concisely and very thoroughly in your resume is incredibly important. And, you know, in 15 minutes in these clinics, 15 to 20 minutes, we can give people a lot of guidance on how to get their resume through filtering and in front of a hiring manager, and how to get the proper information into the brain of the hiring manager.
That's incredible. That sounds so helpful. I wish I had that when I was starting out. So Leslie, you mentioned earlier minorities, women in cyber, BIPOC, getting more diversity in cyber, but specifically you as a woman, you were featured in the book Women Know Cyber, 100 Fascinating Females Fighting Cybercrime, which was published by Cybersecurity Ventures. So what does being a woman in cyber mean to you?
Honestly, I've tried for most of my career to not make it a big facet of who I am. And as you get to be a more senior person, people really expect you to be that role model for other people who are struggling with the issues that lack of diversity in technology causes. And I'm definitely an advocate. I there are very, very clear reasons other than just equality that diversity is really important to technology and cybersecurity in specific. You just don't get as many perspectives without it on your technology, on your products, on your initiatives, et cetera, et cetera. Having diverse backgrounds, diverse people is really important to accomplishing things as organizations. But me personally, things weren't as easy 20 years ago when I got into IT. They really weren't. I've spent a lot of time biting my tongue during my career and knowing which battles to pick up and, when to be outspoken and when to try to compromise and just make things work as best as I could. And things have definitely improved. I think that the next great challenge for technology is integrating people of color. Women have kind of, there's still challenges, there's still opposition to us being there, but a lot of the gaps are closing slowly. Things are improving for women, but we really have to pick up the torch now and advocate for people of color, because there's still a huge gap there in talent, in senior roles. So we really need to lift those people up and help them succeed.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you mentioned picking your battles and biting your tongue, and I've felt that before, and I'm sure everyone has felt that in moments of their life. But I guess to build on that kind of challenge, that type of struggle, what was a challenging moment in your career that you overcame, and how did you overcome it?
Yeah, so challenging moment. When I think about challenging moments in my career, they're mostly the really big mistakes I've made that I've had to overcome. So I think my funniest story that is just a crazy, crazy story is I was a telephone or a telecom tech very early on in my career. And I was, fresh out of the military, and I was very certain of myself. And one day in the dead of winter, we got a call from a very northern mine in Canada. And they said, oh, our router's down. We don't have internet. We don't have any connection to the outside world except for this one phone. This is horrible. And so we spent a couple of days trying to get technicians across the ice sheet to them. And we couldn't do it. Nobody came out there who knew what they were doing. They didn't have the right tools. And I was like, send me. I'll just send me. I'll go fix it. I know snow. I'm from Chicago. So they hand me a laptop and a plane ticket. And so I fly on the little, two-engine turboprop plane to the ice sheet of northern Canada. And of course, it's pitch black in the morning there because it's dark most of the day. And I've got this. This is exciting. This is a big adventure, no problem for Leslie. I'm going to go land on the ice sheet. And I get there and my cell phone doesn't work. There's no cell service and there's no taxis. So I end up hitchhiking to the mine. And I'm so proud of myself because I figured this all out and I've got the router under my arm and the box is getting more beat up as I go. And I finally get to the mine and I go down to a telecom closet in the mine, and they're like, oh, this teenage girl is gonna go fix our stuff. I'm like, oh good. The miners are not pleased because they don't have internet. And so I go down to the telecom room and I unbox everything and I set it up and I'm like, I'm gonna be out of here. Maybe I'll buy a souvenir or something. And I plug in the laptop and I plug in the cable to the router and the cable doesn't work. And I had rushed out of the office without testing everything in advance because I trusted them to hand me stuff that worked, and the cable didn't work. And I'm sitting in this telecom closet in a mine with no cell phone service in the dark with angry miners above me who haven't had internet in days. And I'm like, I can't make it go. And so I sat there and I utterly just about had a nervous breakdown for a few minutes. And then I was like, okay, laptop and cable don't work. What can I do? Well, I'm going to build a new computer. And I start shuffling through their boxes of stuff in the closet. And I put together a new server and I plug it in. I'm like, oh, this works. And then the mine to this day, hopefully does not know the fact that I like built a server in there out of their spare parts to actually connect to the router and set it up. Like while I'm on the phone, their phone with my office going, okay, I'm going to need to build this from scratch because they're going to kill me. If I don't fix this internet, they're going to kill me. I'm never going to be found again. So yeah, that was a tremendous screw up, but it was also a tremendous achievement because I managed to actually come back from that without very angry miners chasing me down. No, they were very nice. I don't think they were very, very unhappy that they didn't have internet though. So.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I mean, I feel like I went through the whole range of human emotion listening, but that is a great story. And I'm glad it had a victorious ending for you. That's awesome. And you were probably very relieved and tired on your trip back. So that's great. And I feel like you gave really great advice earlier with regards to resumes and what to include for hiring managers looking for talent. But what advice would you give to those underrepresented groups looking to build a career in cybersecurity or the tech industry as a whole?
Yeah, so I mentioned previously finding a niche that works for you. I have a lot of junior people who come up to me and they're like, can you mentor me in cybersecurity? And I'm like, but what do you want to do? And they don't know yet because nobody's really introduced them to like what's out there in cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is a tremendously broad field now, and there's a lot of different roles in it. It's hard to be like 20 years ago, you could almost be a generalist in IT, but like now you can barely be a generalist in cybersecurity. You can at like management levels, but as a tech, at like an individual contributor technical role, it's hard, except in very small organizations, to be a jack of all trades. You really do need to specialize in some specific niche of either offensive or defensive computing. And again, the personalities required for each one of those roles is very, very different. The things you'll get out of it, the skill sets you need, the courses you should take, or the training that you should take, or the shadowing you should do as part of your career, that's really different in each of those roles. So trying to figure out where you want to go, it's really important. And it doesn't cost a lot of money to do that. If you can't shadow people in your job, you can definitely watch like conference videos from security conferences and just see what sparks your interest, what you want to read more about, what you want to do, you know, labs or challenges for in your free time. You know, I tell people, try to find something that interests you enough that you want to do it instead of, you know, at the end of the day, sitting there and eating pizza and watching Netflix. You know, you want to find something that interests you at least that much that you want to once in a while do that. So yeah, find a niche and then find mentorship in that niche if you can. And mentorship shouldn't be like this artificial thing. Like, I need a mentor, assign me one. It's like, find somebody who you want to emulate, find somebody who you respect, who you want to do things like, who is where you want to be. And, you know, strike up a conversation with them about the career and how they got there and what advice they have for you. And that's how you build a relationship with a mentor.
Fantastic. It's very actionable. I love that. And finally, you have an upcoming event, Pancakes Con 2, which will be held on Sunday, March 21st. So can you share with us a little about how Pancakes Con was established, what went on during the first one, and what to expect in the second?
Yeah, my very informal con that I do on absolutely shoestring budget. I did it the first one in the first week of lockdown for most places because I just wanted to keep people inside and from, you know, having nervous breakdowns. And it just, I guess people liked it and it became a thing. But the premise of the conference was, because I knew everybody was stressed out, was 40 to 45 minute talks, and half of the talk had to be on a cybersecurity topic, and the other half had to be on something that is totally unrelated to cybersecurity. So cooking or a hobby or music or something. And the point of that was because everybody was stressed out and burnt out and they had short attention spans. And you know, you had to give people a mental break. So you'd spin them up for like 20 minutes on something cybersecurity that they could learn. And then you'd let them wind down learning about like beekeeping, you know, like, so that was the point of the conference, and people really liked it. I had thousands of virtual attendees. So I guess I'm going to do it again. The call for papers for it should be out shortly, and we should have a fun event again.
Awesome. That sounds great. Well, I mean, I want to go.
It's totally free. It's free. It's totally free. It's just going to be a webcast. So. There's a Slack channel and it's going to be streamed to YouTube. So.
Oh, awesome. Great. Well, Leslie, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for joining me on Cybercrime Radio and sharing your story of your career and your wonderful advice.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today was Leslie Carhart, Principal Industrial Incident Responder at Dragos Inc. To learn more about Leslie, you can visit her website at tisiphany.net and follow her on Twitter at hacksforpancakes. And you can listen to all of our podcast episodes at cybercrime.radio.